The Dunbar number is a measure of the cognitive limit to the number of individuals with whom a person can maintain stable relationships. In this talk from Mesh Forum 2006, social software observer Christopher Allen discusses the interesting implications the Dunbar number theory has for the gathering of humans online in the digital age on IT Conversations. Hi, and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm Phil Windley, the executive producer. Today, I'm excited to bring you a presentation from Mesh Forum 2006, held in San Francisco, California, May 7th through 9th.
The Conversations Network is looking for part-time website editors and audio engineers. It's not enough to quit your day job, but we do pay small amounts for each published program. For more information, visit the conversationsnetwork.org website. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network.
And now, here's our presentation from Mesh Forum.
My name's Chris Allen, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Dunbar number. It's been touched by a few people here. Some people may be familiar with the concept, but I wanted to dig into it a little bit further because I think there are some misperceptions about the Dunbar number that I'd like to dig into deeper. The other name of this topic is groups don't scale. So who was Dr. Robin Dunbar? He's a sociologist in an anthropologist in England who studies primate societies. This ranges from monkeys, you know, very, very small monkeys, all the way up to apes and including a little bit on humans. One of the things that he discovered in field studies was there seemed to be this correlation between the size of the cortex of the brain of an ape or a primate and their group size. The smaller the brain, the neocortex was, the smaller it would be, the smaller the groups. The larger the groups. So, you know, given that we kind of have an average neocortex size for a man, he kind of did a correlation, discovered, gosh, 147 would be kind of nice linear match here. So he then looked through literature and discovered that this actually was true, that this 150 number shows up a lot of different times in sociological and anthropological research. Since the release of this hypothesis, this Dunbar number, as it's been called, has been picked up by a number of business authors, most particularly Malcolm Gladwell in his book, The Tipping Point, where he calls it social channel capacity. Unfortunately, due to the popularization of this Dunbar number of 150, I think some of the stuff in the original Dunbar paper has become lost and misunderstood, so I'd like to dig into that a little bit more. If you dig into his research, one of the things you discover is that his mean group size of 150 really applies to communities with a high incentive to remain together, in particular those where survival is important. So this is things like subsistence villages, nomadic tribes, but it also applies to things like ancient armies. It applies to terrorist organizations. It applies to things like The Sopranos, you know, how mafias work. So why is this so? What makes this large group size so difficult? And the reason why is that Dunbar speculates that in order to maintain a group of this size, that you need to spend about 42% of your time grooming, social grooming. Now, what does that mean for apes? That means, you know, picking out the lice and all this kind of stuff. But what it means for humans is being in the same place, glancing at each other in our eyes, talking with one another, listening to one another, responding back and forth. And if you don't do that with your social group, you aren't going to be able to maintain a group of 150 people. You know, if you ever notice, like, you know, if you watch The Sopranos or you watch The Godfather or anything, how much time they spend together. You know, they're at the parties together, they're at work together, they have, you know, dinner and breakfasts and all kinds of stuff together. That's all because they're doing this social grooming that's required to maintain this sort of unstructured trust that they've got to have. Because, you know, Tony Soprano can't go to the feds and say, hey, my underlings aren't following the rules. You know, that's the way unstructured trust works, is they're going to follow the rules because they're part of the group. So obviously there are limits on group size. I mean, we've kind of experienced some of this ourselves. I mean, we're here in a group of, what, 35 people, I guess? And it has a particular feel to it. You know, have you kind of felt like, gosh, this is a big group, but in some ways it's a little small? You know, some of it's the room. I'm sure, Heather, were you still around? Oh, okay. But I'm sure she's played to different audiences, and every performer I've talked to has a different feel for, like, you know, was the audience warm? Was the audience cold? And they often attribute this to how many people there were in the audience. So obviously there's some interesting things that happen with group sizes in our culture, and it's probably not at the 150 number that we've been hearing a lot about. So what are the numbers that apply to sort of our modern culture? In my own research of online communities, I found the existence of a number of limits, mainly from online games. The wonderful thing about online games is that this is a self-selecting type of thing, and we can monitor it. We can see what people are joining and communicating with other people. The first studies on this I got from Ultima Online, which was one of the first big online games. And these are a number of guilds across the bottom. So you can see the different guilds all across here. And then here is their size. And if you notice, there's this big, knee in the curve. And in fact, I talked with the designer of this, and he says there are some specific reasons why there are groups that are larger than 150, but they're very rare and they're very hard to maintain. Because in fact, if you look at the histogram of this same data, you're going to find this interesting result where most of them are actually between like 37 and 85, with, you know, 61 being that nice high point. So you can see this, you know, 61 doesn't come anywhere close to the group size of 150 for a survival group. There's been some more interesting evidence just in the last year that comes from the Worlds of Warcraft. Some researchers at PARC took data for an entire month, 250,000 users, and how did they group during the month? You know, what group did they say they belonged to? What individuals did they actually be on the same server at the same time, or actually be at the same place on the same server at the same time? They were able to graph all of this information for over the course of a month. So they were able to create these very nice network diagrams. And you can see here we have a group that has got these little sort of outlying areas that aren't very cohesive. But then we have this real cohesive group in the center. These are called subgraphs, if you're not familiar with social network analysis. So we have basically a subgraph here that consists of six people. That's the max subgraph of this particular guild. If you take the max subgraph of all the different guilds, you get an interesting thing that happens. So the max subgraph, you know, if everybody was connected to everybody and guilds were continuous, this, of course, would be a straight line up here. But you can see it gets to be more and more difficult as the group sizes go up. And guess what? Right around here, around 77 or so, notice it's starting to get more noisy. And you get up here into these very large groups, it's extremely noisy. So that says something about the nature of that particular community, that as they got up to be that high, it was very difficult for them to maintain that cohesion. It was harder work. And some of them failed, and some of them succeeded. But there are other nodal points that you can get out of this data. This is something that's called the subgraph ratio. Okay, that's another measure of cohesiveness of groups. And basically, it's the max subgraph divided by the number of members in the group, and then compared against the size. And you get some interesting things here, one of which is that it's really easy to form a group, up to about, 10, 12 people. And it gets increasingly harder and harder and harder to maintain cohesiveness compared to these smaller groups up here when you've got groups that are, 150 or 200 some odd people. So my own personal hypothesis based on this information is that the size of groups can have a profound impact on how the groups behave and how they work and what tools and stuff will work for them. My own hypothesis is that there seem to be these two nodal sizes. There's one that's sort of, you know, between like, you know, 5 and 11 or so, that groups that behave in a particular way, and there are certain group processes and software that seem to work very well for them. And then we have another one that seems to kind of peak around 50 people and then drops off toward the Dunbar number. But then we have this little interesting valley of at around 13, 14, 15, where you know, these small group processes don't seem to work, and these large group processes you don't have enough people for yet. You know, some people call that the Judas number. You know, all of a sudden the group starts breaking up, can't work well, function very well at 13. So I found this in many, many different things. I've seen it in conferences. I've seen it in companies. The company, when I'm doing angel investing, that's at 13, 14 people, I know I got to watch them very carefully. They're either going to boom and go up to like 20, 25 people and start being successful, or they're going to collapse back down to a more sustainable small team size. So how do we identify group size problems? I'm just going to quickly run through this. The most important, which when you're to recognize too small, is there's insufficient critical mass. You're unable to sustain a conversation. You know, things kind of, people kind of talk and aren't listening, and you kind of feel like you're alone or that nobody is responding. Another thing that can happen even when there is conversation is you can have groupthink or echo chamber. That's when everybody's kind of saying the same thing. Oh, I agree with you. Bush is a terrible president. Bush is a terrible president. You know, there isn't any actual exchange of information happening. So that's an example of too few. Too many, the most obvious is too noisy, and we've all experienced this. You know, how many times you've belonged to a mailing list that was great, and then everybody thought, oh, I got to be a member of this mailing list, and then now the mailing list is too noisy, and it's not worth participating in. Another category of recognizing too many people is this lack of trust or unequal trust. One of my theories about the Dunbar number, what causes the Dunbar number is that we lose just sort of that innate internal trust that we have in our heads, and we start having to rely on external things. Like, did you, you know, give me as much as your time? Did you call me back as often as I've called you? You know, you start, you know, measuring whether or not you're getting the results that you want from your community rather than just saying, oh, that, you know, the community works. This is fun. The cliques and bad gossip is another thing that's a classic sign of a group growing too big. Inappropriate politics. I think there's always going to be, you know, politics. I mean, I think it's, you know, the nature of the beast. But it can get inappropriate. It can get, you know, where the politics so much dominate the discussion that it becomes bad for the group. And that can be very much a sign of too many people. Other social contract failures, flames, trolls, tragedy of the commons. My take is that social software isn't really aware of the Dunbar number. They don't, you know, when the LiveJournal people originally came out with their software, I don't think they really necessarily understood that that intimate social network was probably going to be around, you know, 10, 12 people, and that the sort of larger social network would be 150 people. They discovered that, and it turns out that the LiveJournal software is very good for it, but they didn't design for it, I don't believe. It just sort of happened that was the sweet space. I think as a software designer, we can start looking at these types of things and actually design these kind of understandings. And one of the first packages that I've seen for intimate social networks that was designed with the sizes in mind is a product called YakPak, which if any of you guys are investigating software, you should take a look at. It's YakPak. And it's really trying to do software for intimate social networks. You know, your grandchildren talking to their grandparents and stuff like that. So small groups. Obviously, chat rooms. You ever try to do a chat room with more than 12 people? So small groups, chat rooms. Teleconference with back channel tends to work with smaller groups. Cooperative editors. I have a little product called SynchroEdit that is open source. You get more than like 8-9 people on there, it's not fun anymore. Flat discussion lists tend to work pretty well with smaller groups. Blogs shared only to private, that's the example of LiveJournal. But also team blogs. I see very, very few good team blogs that have more than like authors, more than like nine or so authors together. You have the same kind of thing happen. I don't know how many people were active with World Changing when you left.
Well, active is the question because.
Yeah, and that's that ratio, by the way, I've seen at all kinds of levels. Medium groups, these are the ones that are sort of the, you know, with the center around the 50 of optimum. Instant message groups, I've seen lots of, you know, groups of 100, you know, 50 or so people who instant message each other. Avatar chat tends to be able to support a few more people than, say, a chat room. Threaded discussion lists become more important for this size group because you need to be able to divert into different topics. And then wikis. This is the first place where wikis really start working. I've found very few small groups that can maintain a wiki as well as a group that is this large. Finally, for large groups, these are the ones that are in excess of the Dunbar number. And the key thing with groups that are for software that is beyond that is you've got to get to what, you know, out of unstructured trust, where you trust that other people are going to participate, the trust that other people are going to give equal value to the value that you gave to the group. You're going to have to put more trust built into the software. And so that includes things like reputation filtering, a la Slashdot, Avogadro, etc., or Wiki, which is another way of you can have multiple workspaces. I don't know why I quite have blogs, public blogs in here, because they're obviously, you know, public blogs that are for small groups. But I think the people that feel like their public blog was successful, that it was worth their while to do, you know, the Scoble class blog, won't feel happy unless they have over 150 readers. Whereas the small blog will be quite happy to have just his friends and family reading. And of course, you know, there's some interesting things being done with social networks, of which I think the best example is MySpace. And part of the reason why I think MySpace was so successful was social network was a feature of the software, not, you know, the fundamental offering of the software. My blog is called Life with Alacrity. I write on these topics. I have a lot of different posts on the Dunbar number, including things like discussion about Dunbar triage. How do you handle, you know, lots of connections? What are the strategies for handling lots of connections? Some more anecdotal and empirical evidence of existence of these nodal sizes, and a lot of other topics about social software and collaboration. And my point in one of the earlier slides was I think every performer that I know has talked about, you know, warm rooms and cold rooms and all this kind of stuff, and a lot of them have said that size, the amount of their kind of audience can very much, you know, make for a very different type of. And I think that, you know, comes back to my earlier point about grooming, the social grooming, the fact that a church is willing to spend the time with its members. And, you know, when you get greeted, when you come in the door, hi, Chris, welcome back to the church. I haven't seen you for a couple of months, you know. You know, those types of things are all elements and parts of that social grooming process that allow for, a group to be able to be larger and yet still be that kind of intimacy.
You know, I think that one reason why the Scoble class, or you know, for that matter, world-changing size blogs like to have more than 150 readers is because only about 10% at best of the readers, in my experience at least, will participate in the commentary. And just to riff off what Heather was saying earlier, you get a lot of energy from the blog based on the activity of the audience. And so if you have at least 150 readers, then you probably have 10 people who are regularly commenting. If you want to have 150 commenters, you need to have 1,500 whatever readers.
You know, the old number I used in AOL days, this was back, late 80s, was that out of 100 lurkers, you might create 10 occasional posters. And out of those 10 posters, you might get one active poster. But what's kind of interesting, though, there was this weird dynamic that was the other side of it. If you could convert one of those lurkers to a semi-active user, you would get 10 users. But if you were able to convert one person to become an active participant, all of a sudden you'd have 100 more readers. It was this weird dynamic where, you know, if you grew these, I spent my time when I was a forum leader on America Online really concentrating on those one percenters, because it seemed like every time I created a new one of those in my group, my forum usage would increase hugely.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at Mesh Forum, held in San Francisco, California, May 7th through 9th, 2006.
The Conversations Network is looking for part-time website editors and audio engineers. It's not enough to quit your day job, but we do pay small amounts for each published program. For more information, visit the conversationsnetwork.org website. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Bruce Sharp. Our website editor was Liz Evans. The series producer is Sean Osteen.
This is Phil Windley, and I look forward to bringing you more from Mesh Forum here on IT Conversations.